And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today we're going to produce a very sobering podcast. I'll talk about that a little more in just a moment. Let me say as prologue that our liberal democracy is now degenerating into something that resembles totalitarianism. The liberal part of liberal democracy is not meant as an allusion to the radical left. It refers to the liberties or freedoms that a government is mandated to guarantee its citizens. And that includes freedom of religion, of speech, of assembly, of press, and even extends to the right of owning private property. The democracy part of liberal democracy refers to self-government and equality of citizens under the law, ultimate accountability of the government to the people. And there have been many benefits to our liberal democracy. I'm talking about benefits like the liberty to worship, to hold the government accountable, to vote, to buttress concepts such as natural law and natural rights. And all of this means our liberal democracy provides space and protection for Christians to act for the advancement of justice. It takes into account humanity's propensity for evil, humanity's dignity. But there are conditions that are necessary for a liberal democracy to thrive. When the rule of law is diminished, the structure under which people's rights are protected falls alongside it. One of the most powerful statements I have ever heard in this regard happens to come from an American statesman. He was the second president of the United States of America. His name, of course, John Adams. And he said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to govern any other. And today, we want to talk about what we are losing, perhaps what we have lost, with one of the most important voices in the Christian world. In fact, let me expand that. I would say one of the most important voices in the world, period. That's a big statement. But I believe that with all my heart. Today we're talking to Rod Dreher. He's a senior editor at the American Conservative. He's written for all kinds of prestigious publications, the New York Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, many others. And he's written incredibly insightful books. Some of you may recall the Benedict Option, which was a strategy. It is a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation. But the book that I'm particularly interested in today for this podcast is a recent book by Rod Dreher, which is titled Live Not by Lies. And it's a manual for Christian dissidents. We'll talk about what that means. Rod has read the signs of the times, and he is preparing us for a new dark age. Current trends may not spell the end of the world, but they do spell the end of a world. Not the world, but a world. People alive today may well live to see the effective death of Christianity within Western civilization. That means that we as Christians have a dramatic role to play. And that is right now in the present. The question is, are we ready? Rod Dreher I am delighted, as always, to have you on the podcast. I loved your book, The Benedict Option, which, by the way, was misunderstood by many people. But I love your book, Live Not by Lies, perhaps even more. It's a book that I've read, I would say not just read, but digested. So I'm just delighted to have you on the podcast.
Well, Hank, it's always great to be with you. And thank you so much for your very kind words about my work.
Well, your work is important, and I hope that people listening into this podcast will really pay attention and then use the podcast as an impetus to get the book and then to not just read the book, but to digest the book, because the future of Western civilization lies in our understanding of what is going on and then providing the resistance that is necessary. You're quoting Alexander Solzhenitsyn with the title of your book.
That's right. Live Not by Lies is the name of the book, and it's also the name of an essay that Solzhenitsyn sent out. It's really too short to be an essay. It's more or less a letter to his followers in the Soviet Union in 1974 on the eve of his expulsion from the Soviet Union for his human rights activities. And he sent this message out telling his people, his followers, do not live by lies. What did he mean by that? It meant that they couldn't hope to overthrow the totalitarian government there, but it did mean that they could stop accepting without protest all of the lies and all the propaganda that the Soviet state compelled its citizens to affirm, or at least not to oppose. He said that if you're afraid that you have no choice but to conform, that's the lie that gives all the other lies their force in the Soviet Empire. So what did it mean to live not by lies? He said that the person who lives in truth will not say, will not write or affirm or distribute anything that distorts the truth. He won't go to a demonstration unless he truly believes in the cause. He won't take part in a meeting in which a discussion is forced and no one can speak the truth, and so on and so forth. Solzhenitsyn said that these might seem like small things, but if enough people did them and showed to each other that they were willing to dissent and to refuse to give their consent to the system might change.
You, in this book, use the power of story to communicate or underscore the logical truth propositions that are encapsulated in the book. I want you to talk about how you start this book. You start it with the story of an elderly mother, a Czech immigrant, who experienced communism firsthand. And that's one of the most insightful stories, because this story got you thinking about maybe what's going on in the West today has a facsimile in past history.
Yeah, it was really shocking to me, Hank. Back in 2015, I got a phone call from someone I didn't know. He's a physician in the Midwest, and he was put in touch with me by a mutual friend, and he said, I have to tell somebody what's going on. He said, my elderly mother is an immigrant to this country. She came here from Czechoslovakia. She's living with me and my wife. And she's telling me, son, the things I see happening in America today remind me of what it was like when communism first came to my home country. And this had particular force for the man who called me, the doctor, because his mother had spent 4 years in a Czechoslovak prison camp for practicing her Catholic faith. And the man said he didn't know what to make of it, but he knew that it wasn't just his mother just talking off the top of her head. He felt that somebody needed to know. Well, Hank, I thought that that was probably just an old lady watching too much cable TV and getting scared. My mother is old. She watches a lot of TV, and she often gets scared, too, by the news. So I reached out to this couple I know in the UK, Bela and Gabby Bolabash. They defected from Hungary in the 1960s. Bela was a math genius, a young math genius. They took up residence in Cambridge, England. Bela became a world-famous mathematician teaching at Trinity College, though he's now retired. Well, I contacted them because I trusted them, and I said, listen, this old Czech woman says that she's seeing things that remind her of communism now, and I just got to know, is she kind of off her rocker, or is there something to it? They wrote back right away and said, oh, no, it's really happening. We see it here in England. Every day when we watch the news or read the papers, we say to each other, this is what it was like when we were young back in Hungary. Well, hey, because I knew these people, I knew that this was something serious. So I made it my business for the next few years, whenever I would travel to give speeches or go to conferences, if I would meet someone who grew up in the Soviet bloc, either Russia or one of the Eastern Bloc nations, I would just put the question to them, are you seeing things now that remind you of what things were like back home? Every single one of them, Hank, says yes. And if you talk to them long enough, they would get really angry at the fact that Americans would pay no attention to them.
Yeah, when you say see it happening, you're talking about things like reinventing language, hollowing out words, and rewriting history.
Absolutely. I would ask them, well, what forms do you see this taking? Because, you know, looking around, I'm a pretty good observer of the news. This is what I do for a living. But I didn't see anything that reminded me of Stalinism 2.0. And they would say, no, it's not like that, but it's similar to that. And the main thing that they're seeing now is people being afraid to say what's on their minds for fear of losing their job or having their reputation ruined or even being attacked physically. They said this was how it first started. In fact, the thing that triggered the Czech woman was news reports of what happened to Memories Pizza. I don't know if you remember that, but back in 2015, just before the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage, the state of Indiana passed a state version of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act that would have given religious folks an affirmative defense in court if they were ever sued for discrimination. It wouldn't guarantee that they would win, but it would give them some affirmative legal defense. Well, when, and this is already, by the way, a federal law. It has been federal law since 1993. When the state of Indiana, a Republican state, did this, big business came down on them like a ton of bricks, denounced this as bigoted legislation, and told the state, if you don't repeal this, there will be consequences. At the same time this was going on, a TV station from Indianapolis went to this small pizza parlor in a tiny town called Walkerton, Indiana. The pizza parlor was owned by an evangelical father and his adult daughter. The TV reporter asked them, would you serve gay customers? Of course, they said. She asked them, would you cater a gay wedding? Well, no, they said, this is against our faith. That went out on television, Hank, and it became viral on social media. Before you knew it, these poor people, this poor couple, were being hit with death threats, with tweeted threats saying, let's get together and burn this place down, and so on and so forth. They had to close it and go into hiding. This is precisely the thing that the old Czech woman was seeing happen that made her say, this is what they did when communism first came to my country. Since 2015, Hank, this so-called cancel culture has become far, far more powerful. And this is the main thing that these people are seeing. But of course, it's not only that. It's, as you say, it's the redefinition of language. It's the redefinition of male and female. And it's the spread of big tech into every aspect of our lives.
Yeah, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, who had this sneaky attack on the core essence of communal Christianity, called into question the very necessity of embodied worship. These kinds of sneaky attacks are really the essence of soft totalitarianism versus hard totalitarianism. Perhaps you can expand on that.
Sure, that's a key definition. Whenever we think of the term totalitarianism, we naturally think of the Soviet Union, of Stalinism, of gulags, of secret police and torture. We think of George Orwell's 1984. But what we're going to be dealing with now is not really that. I don't think so. And most of the people I talk to from the communist bloc don't think so either, though they do warn it could turn hard very quickly. Soft totalitarianism, what makes it softer are two different things. First of all, it's not going to require the secret police to enforce and torture. This is something that's going to be done instead by institutions and through what I believe is going to be an American version of the Chinese social credit system. Now, your listeners might not know what the social credit system is, so I need to very briefly explain that. In China today, The Chinese government collects data constantly from every Chinese citizen based on their smartphone use and based on their internet use. And it's constantly revising this information, feeding it all into a computer to come up with a social credit rating for each Chinese citizen. The social credit rating tells everybody who can see it how reliable, what a good citizen you are or a bad citizen you are. If you do things like download the speeches of Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, well, that makes your score go higher. But if you do bad things, antisocial things like go to church, you get a much lower score. The lower your score, the fewer privileges you have in society. And in fact, all the people who know you on social media and in your family, if they don't disassociate themselves from you, if you have a low score, their score will go down. Eventually, Hank, the Chinese can make it where you cannot buy or sell or participate at all in the economy if you have a sufficiently low social credit score. So this is an ingenious way of forcing conformity by marginalizing people and kicking them out of the economy if they don't conform. The Chinese do have secret police, but they don't have to send them around to people's houses to enforce the dogma. Now, here's the thing. We have the same capabilities right here in the United States. In fact, our major corporations are gathering this data all the time from our smartphone use, from our computers, from the way we use our credit cards. And this is all completely legal. This is not conspiracy theory. It's totally legal. We give them all this data. The thing that we have to watch out for now is that they might weaponize this data against us to identify who the bad people are, the people who go to church, the people who vote Republican, the people who read bad antisocial things, and so on and so forth. This is a softer form of totalitarianism where the state, should it decide to do so, and major corporations, should they decide to do so, will be able to punish us without ever sending the secret police to our door. Secondly, the thing that makes soft totalitarianism soft, Hank, is it's being done in the name of compassion. It's being done to protect favored minorities, particularly LGBTs and racial minorities, from victimization. But what they're doing in order to accomplish this worthy goal, a goal that, you know, all Christians would agree with in general, nobody should be victimized and certainly shouldn't be the victims of racism or things like that. But what they're doing is creating a structure, a permanent inquisition and totalitarian command in order to achieve this. Those aren't my words. Those are the words of René Girard, who is one of the 20th century's most accomplished intellectuals. He saw this coming 20 years ago and warned about it. Now we're here.
And we're willing participants in the process because we love happiness and convenience.
Absolutely. I have to tell people that George Orwell's 1984 is not the book that we need to consult to understand our times. We need rather to look at Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which was also a totalitarian dystopia, but it was one based not on pain and the infliction of terror, but rather the manipulation of status and comfort and good feeling by the state. This is what we're dealing with now. In fact, I tell the story in Live Not by Lies about my translator in Hungary when they're reporting this book. She's a young Catholic woman, maybe 29, 30 years old, been married 5 years at the time, had one small child and one on the way. She was telling me as we were on the tram going through the city, she said, "You know, Rod, I don't understand why it is that I can't have a conversation with any of my friends about the struggles I'm going through being a mom and a wife." She said, "Every time I try to raise something with them, they immediately cut me off and say, 'Well, just leave your husband, put your son in daycare, go back to work. You'll be happier that way.'" She said, "I want to tell them, 'No, you don't understand. I am happy being a wife. I'm happy being a mom, but it's not easy all the time.'" She said, "My friends cannot understand that unhappiness, that anxiety, that stress is just a normal part of being a person, and we have to learn to live with it." I looked at her and said, "Anna, sounds like you're fighting for your right to be unhappy." She said, "That's it. That's exactly it. Where did you get that?" Well, I took out my smartphone and went to chapter 17 of Brave New World, where there's this big showdown between the dictator, Mustafa Mond, and the savage who's living outside of society. The dictator, Mond, says to the savage, come join us. We offer you Christianity without tears. There's no suffering here. We give you all the drugs you want, all the sex and entertainment you want. What's not to like? The savage says, no, I want real life. I want suffering. I want sin. I want God. I want beauty. He wants to be a human, is what he's saying. Mond looks at him, Hank, and says, it sounds like you're fighting for the right to be unhappy. He said, I am. Mond says, well, you're welcome to it. This is us, Hank. This is where we are today. We're so afraid of being bored and unhappy and anxious that we're willing to surrender our political liberties and our civil liberties and even our faith for the promise, the false promise of security and permanent happiness.
Yeah, you know, I was really struck by the story of the man to whom you dedicate Live Not by Lies. Can you tell that story and maybe elaborate on three significant words that are part of the story, which now have become part of the book and a template for us to follow, see, judge, and act?
Sure. Thank you for asking that question. I had no idea this man even existed before I went to Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia, and started talking to people in the underground church. And they said, we owe it all to this man, Father Tomislav Kolakovic. Father Kolakovic was born in Croatia. His last name was Paglian, but he joined the Jesuits and was doing underground work against the Nazis in Zagreb in 1943 when he got a tip that the Gestapo was coming after him. He sneaked out of the country, went to his mother's homeland, Slovakia, and adopted her last name, Kolakovic, to hide out. He got a job teaching in the Catholic University there, and he told his students, he said, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is the Nazis are going to lose this war, but the bad news is when they're finally defeated, the communists are going to be ruling this country, and the first thing they're going to do, students, is come after the church. We've got to be ready for them. So what he did was organize cells of, they were prayer groups, but they were also debate societies for young Christians to come together to talk about what they were seeing in the world around them and what they were called to do as followers of Jesus Christ to resist. Part of the things they would do would be to learn things like the arts of resistance, like how to resist an interrogation once they came to see what was really going on. These prayer groups spread all across the country. Any town of any size had a Kolakovic group in it. He called them his family. Now, the bishops of Slovakia told him, you're being alarmist. Things will never get as bad as you say. Why keep scaring people? Father Kolakovic respected them, but he didn't listen to them because he had studied in the Vatican for missionary work in the Soviet Union and knew a lot about the Soviet mindset. So he just kept at it. And not only would he teach people to pray, how to pray together, but he taught them this method that you mentioned earlier, a method of discerning what to do in this crisis. It was called See, Judge, Act. What he meant by that was that his group would try to see what was going on. That is to say, they would talk about what's happening in our society. They would identify the conditions that they needed to discuss. Then in the judge mode, they would talk among themselves with their pastors and with others involved in the group who had wisdom and tried to figure out what it was that they could do and what they should do on the basis of the facts in front of them, in line with the teachings of the church. And of course, ACT was to go forth from the meeting and put the plan into action. Very simple, see, judge, act, but this formed the basis of the underground church in Slovakia because when the communists came to power in 1948, they kicked Father Kolakovic out, and the first thing they did, as he had prophesied, they came after the churches. But because Father Kolakovic had prepared the laity and sympathetic priests for this persecution, the family, Father Kolakovic's family, became the underground church, and they were the only significant resistance to communism in that country for the next 40 years.
I mean, they were instrumental in the Velvet Revolution that was so instrumental in overthrowing communism.
Absolutely. I was told the most amazing story, and I relate this in the book. When I was in Bratislava and first learned about Father Kolakowicz, a man who was sort of, I guess you could call him the second generation of followers, a church historian, took me to a house in suburban Bratislava, an ordinary house. We went into the basement, and he showed me a secret passageway underneath the basement. We had to crouch down and go in a tunnel, and we came up, Hank, in a tiny little room that's behind a wall under the basement. In this room, there was an offset printing machine. This was where the underground church for 10 years, starting in around 1979, 1980, where it produced gospels and catechisms and prayer books, things like that, with an offset printing machine that evangelicals in the Netherlands had smuggled into Slovakia to help the Catholic underground church. Just a beautiful example of ecumenism in action. And the church historian told me, his name is Jan Simulczyk. Jan said that he did not know about the existence of this room until after the fall of communism. It was a very closely held secret in the underground church. But he himself, as a college student in the early 1980s, used to come to that same house as part of his cell within the underground church structure. His job and the job of the three or four young men who were with him was simply to come in and bind together all the things that had been printed illegally. They all knew, they didn't know what was happening in the basement, but they all knew that if they had been caught, that they would all go to prison. But Jan said being able to do this week in and week out with these other young men strengthened his faith in Christ and his faith in the other members of the body of Christ. He said doing this for a decade gave us the courage to finally go out when the underground church called the first public demonstration in Czechoslovakia since the 1968 Soviet invasion. This was the so-called candle demonstration in Bratislava in 1988. Jan Simulczyk and his friends went out to this, and he said that if we had not been working together through our fear to serve the underground church and to serve Jesus Christ in this way, we would not have had the courage to go out onto the square with our candles and pray in public, even though we had to face down the water cannons of the communist regime. That was the event, the candle march in 1988, that kicked off the process that led to the Velvet Revolution the year following. And it all started because Father Kolakowicz had a vision for resistance.
You know, what's interesting about this, as I hear you talk, Rod, is the proximity between the Velvet Revolution and the time in which you and I are now speaking. I mean, it's not all that many years.
Oh, it was 1989. I mean, but in that time, Hank, I mean, you and I were both raised, you're a little older than I am, but we were both raised during the Cold War. We had very clear memories of what that was like. But now, all of that seems to have been sent right down the memory hole in our society. I spoke to this one young woman as I was reporting the book, a young woman in California, university educated, 26 years old. She said to me that she thinks communism is just a great idea, that the idea of the brotherhood of man, everybody being equal, what a wonderful idea. And I said to her, well, what about the gulags? How do you reconcile the gulags with your enthusiasm for communism? She looked at me and said, well, what are the gulags? She genuinely had no idea. Nobody had ever told her about the prison camps, about the KGB, about all this repression. It was all had just faded into the mist like the Middle Ages or the Roman and Greek times. This is one of the reasons that we're in so much trouble now, Hank, is because all this stuff has been forgotten. And I don't think it's accidental, to be honest.
Yeah, I love that phrase, the memory hole. In fact, I don't think I've heard that before. This is the systemic problem. I mean, we don't know history. And as has been well said, if you don't know history, you're resigned to repeat history.
Well, not only that, if you don't know history, you are perpetually a child. Memory hole, by the way, I think the phrase comes from George Orwell from 1984. That was the way the state in 1984 kept control of people, by controlling their collective memory. I write in Live Not By Lies about how this is one of the main ways that we have to resist soft totalitarianism is by cultivating cultural memory. What I meant by that is this. Back when the Nazis invaded Poland in 1939, there was no way that ordinary Poles could really take up weapons against the Wehrmacht. But they knew, because the Germans were very clear about this, that they were going to try to subjugate the Polish nation, not only by arms, but by destroying their sense of nationhood, of a separate people, and by destroying their Catholic religion. So a young man, a young seminarian named Karol Wojtyła, the future John Paul II, he and his friends involved in the theater would get together to defend their country and their people by writing plays that would keep the memory of Poland as a nation, as a historical people alive, and also keep the Catholic faith alive. They would perform these plays in the underground in front of audiences who had secretly shown up at like basements to watch this, all of them risking their lives. But they knew that Poland was not going to survive Nazi totalitarianism if they didn't remind people who they were. Now, this sort of thing repeated itself in the Eastern Bloc. And in Live Not By Lies, I tell the story about the seminars that the dissidents would have in their apartments, where they would gather people around, anybody who wanted to hear it. They would talk about politics, really, because that would get them thrown in prison. But they would talk about literature and art and history, the sort of things that were not they were not getting in the communist-controlled schools, because they realized that they didn't know when communism would end or if it would end in their lifetimes, but they knew that there would be no way to resist it if people weren't reminded of who they were as a people and as people of God.
You know, I was thinking of a particular quote that I love. It's sort of emblazoned on my mind. It's a quote by Jacob Neusner, who reminds us of what's called the gossamer strand. He says that civilization hangs suspended from generation to generation by the gossamer strand of memory. If only one cohort of mothers and fathers fails to convey to its children what it has learned from its parents, then the great chain of learning and wisdom snaps. If the guardians of human knowledge stumble only one time, in their fall collapses the whole edifice of knowledge and understanding. And you've pointed out in many different ways that we talk about evangelizing the world or reaching the world when we can't even teach our own children.
No, no, we can't. I mean, if you look at the statistics for the millennial generation and the one behind it, Generation Z, they're falling away from the church in numbers that we have never seen in American history. And even those who stay don't seem to know why they're Christian, what it means to be Christian. And this is not something that the government has done to us. This is something we in the church have done to ourselves. And I write about this in The Benedict Option, my previous book, but it's also applicable to Live Not By Lies. We have turned Christianity into self-help. We have made people, raised a generation or two generations now, up to think that to be a Christian is to be nice, is to recognize God, but to think that all God wants of us is to be nice to other people and to be happy. And that's just about it. The sociologist of religion, Christian Smith at Notre Dame University, has done lots of research on this. And he says the de facto faith of American Christians across all denominational boundaries is what he calls moralistic therapeutic deism. It's an empty, parasitic cult on real, authentic, historical, biblical Christianity. It's something that just is meant to make us feel good. And if we don't teach something much more disciplined, much deeper, theologically, historically, and biblically to our young people, that gossamer strand that you talked about, Hank, it will be severed. And it is being severed right now. I talked about the gossamer strand reminded me of a story I tell in Live Not By Lies. I was sitting in Warsaw in Poland talking to a professor who's the head of the John Paul II Center there, and he said that humanity is like a kite that flies high in the sky. It can fly very high indeed as long as it is connected by the string to someone on the ground. But if you cut that string, then the kite will circle and finally hit the ground. He likened the string to faith in God. And I would say not only faith in God, but based on Rabbi Neusner's comment that you just said, I would describe it the memory of what it means to be Christian. We cut that, we're doomed.
Yes. And we also need to inculcate in the next generation, or this generation, perhaps I should say, the quality of discernment skills, because there are so many things masquerading today as one thing that are quite simply something entirely different. For example, left-wing totalitarianism is masquerading as kindness, and without discernment skills, you simply don't get that.
That's right. I've been really, really troubled by some of the things I've seen on my own side. I'm a political conservative and a theological conservative, but I've seen so many people on my own side lately talking about how God told me this. God told me to go do this. God told me that this is right. There's no discernment there at all. It's total subjectivism. You know, I'm an Orthodox Christian like you are. I was a Catholic before I was Orthodox. And in both of these traditions that come out of the deep Christian past, we are taught private revelation is something to be deeply suspected. God really does speak to some of us, but you don't just assume that because you've had a thought and it seems like it might be God, that it is God. You have to discern it in conversation with your spiritual father, with your priest, by reading the Bible, and test the spirits. We're in an age now where nobody, whether they're Christian or secular, nobody tests the spirits, so to speak. They seem to believe that if they feel it, it must be true. And in Christian circles, we baptize it.
Yeah. Let's talk about something that we alluded to earlier, and that is the hollowing out of words and phrases. I'm thinking about something that you write about extensively in Live Not by Lies, and that is social justice. I was struck by that because I picked up and read a series of sermons, a patristic series that is forwarded by St. Vladimir's. And in fact, I wrote a foreword to one of these books. But this book was on social justice. It was a series of sermons by St. Basil. And he talks about social justice, the importance of social justice. But now you're writing about social justice in a completely different way. So we have the same word or the same phrase, but there's an entirely new meaning that's packed into that phrase, demonstrating that words and phrases are not univocal, they're equivocal. And so we have a cult of social justice. We have social justice warriors. We have social justice as a pseudo-religion, as a cult, but there's also a legitimate form of social justice. Help us to distinguish.
Well, this is crucially important because we hear the word social justice so much. We hear it taken up in many churches, too, as something that God wants. And indeed, God does want a socially just world, by which the Christian tradition teaches is a world that is structured so that everybody within it can receive what he is due and can live out God's plan for his life individually. But this requires social structures, the economic structures and other structures that make this more possible. I love what Peter Maurin, the co-founder with Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement, Peter Maurin wants to find a just society as one in which it's easier to be good. I think that's a good working definition. That's not what secular social justice calls for today. Secular social justice believes that justice is only a matter of rearranging the power relationships among groups. Now, this is something that comes up straight out of Karl Marx. The Bolsheviks, the revolutionaries who took over Russia, they preached, following Marx, that goodness and evil is something that didn't really exist, but it should be understood as the power relations between the proletariat, that is the working class, and the bourgeoisie, which is the capitalist class. The good people were the proletariat, and the bad people were the capitalist and the bourgeoisie, the middle class. And after we had a revolution, a bloody revolution that would overthrow the bad people, then we would be in utopia. Well, this is fundamentally a religious idea. The Bolsheviks didn't believe in God, but this was a fundamentally religious idea that denied what we know about human nature. It denied that there was any such thing as justice that involved individuals. So you ended up right after the revolution in 1918, you had a man named Martin Latsis, who was the head of the secret police in Ukraine. He sent out a directive to his agents telling them how to carry out Lenin's so-called Red Terror. That was a campaign of murder and mass arrest that was intended to crush any opposition to the Bolsheviks. Latsis said, don't go into villages and look at people and try to figure out what they individually did. Rather, just figure out which class they belong to and then punish them according to that. That, he said, is the essence of Red Terror. Well, so now in our society, nobody's talking about murdering people or sending them to prison camps, at least not yet. But we do hear constantly that in order to have a socially just society, we have to suppress white, male, heterosexual, Christian, and so forth in favor of those who are structured by the left wing as the deserving marginalized. And what's so terrible about this is the individual doesn't have any standing. The only way he has any meaning at all socially, and this idea of social justice, is as a bearer of his group identity. And you know, it's so horribly un-Christian, it's so horribly unfair, but we're in a position now where if you are against any of this, you get accused of being against social justice. You're accused of wanting to perpetuate injustice. It's a form of propaganda to fool people and to make them feel guilty for having deep misgivings about what is being sold as social justice.
You know, you've brought up the Bolsheviks, and I want to expand on that a little later on in the podcast, but I'm struck by a phrase that you used just a few moments ago, and that is, we are doing this to ourselves. We've seen the triumph of the therapeutic within churches, within Christian communities. We've seen what I've once called the austenification of American Christianity. The fact that God wants us to be happy, or the idea that God wants us to be happy as opposed to being set apart or holy. Can you expand on the problem of the church and how the church is contributing to the collapse of Western civilization?
Right. We are supposed to be salt and light, and the salt has definitely lost its savor and the light has been dimmed. And this is because we've not been faithful to our baptism. You talk about the triumph of the therapeutic. That is the title of a great book that came out in 1966, written by a secular Jew. He was a social critic named Philip Reif, R-I-E-F-F. And Reif, though he was not a believer, he said that the world that we're in now is collapsing precisely because we don't recognize any higher authority, as happened under, when we lived by the Bible. You know, we believed in the Ten Commandments. We believed that there was something beyond ourselves that we all had to submit to, even if we didn't necessarily believe in God personally. And what has happened, said Reif, in the 20th century after Freud, we all came to believe that we can never ultimately know God, that God doesn't exist, but we can learn how to moderate our own anxieties and to deal with our own unhappiness. So after Freud, the idea of of holiness was done for. There was no such thing anymore. Rather, we sought well-being. We sought feeling good about ourselves. And this, said Philip Reif in 1966, he said, the churches don't realize it, but they've already been conquered by this false gospel. And it's astonishing to read this book, Hank, this book from 1966, and to see how much this man, who wasn't even a religious believer, understood about the corruption overtaking the churches. Fast forward to 2017, just before my book, The Benedict Option, came out, I was speaking at a conservative evangelical college here in the U.S., and I was giving a talk about the importance of spiritual disciplines in daily life. In the Q&A part, a young woman stood up, raised her hand and said, "Sir, I don't understand what you mean about spiritual discipline. Why isn't it enough for us to love Jesus with all our hearts as our parents taught us?" And I said to her, "Well, that's where we start. We have to love Jesus with all our hearts, but we can't hold on to that emotion forever, that we have to show that we love him by obeying his commandments. And we can only really do that if we live in disciplined ways." You can imagine what I said to her, but I could see in her eyes, she had no idea what I was talking about. After that exchange was over, a professor came up to me and said, "What that young lady said to you is how 99% of the students on this campus feel. That's how they think about the Christian life. So when they've come up through youth group culture that has taught them that knowing Christ is entirely relational. Jesus is my best friend. There's nothing in there about discipleship, about asceticism, about repentance, none of that. And so when they get off of this college campus, which is kind of a bubble for them, straight out of youth group to an evangelical college campus, they get out into the real world. The first time somebody comes up to them and says, what Christianity teaches is mean, they collapse, because the one thing they've learned from their youth group and their time here at the college is that Jesus doesn't want us to be mean. So this, I'm sorry for that long digression, but this sort of thing, I've heard it play out in Catholic circles, even among some Orthodox. This is what it means to be a Christian in 21st century America. But insofar as that's what it means to be Christian, it means that our children and our grandchildren will no longer have the faith. The gossamer thread will have been cut, not by our hostility to Christianity, but by our watering it down, by showing contempt for the tradition we've actually been given, by watering it down with compassion. Compassion is a form of contempt.
Yeah, and being nice sort of involves getting rid of common sense. It gets into all kinds of things that we're teaching kids right now. Be nice. Well, that's translated into accepting things that are completely antithetical to common sense. I'm thinking right now about the transgender phenomenon, which you write about in the book. We've been cowed into affirming psychological maxims over biological realities. And this is a culmination of a process that started a long, long time ago, but now it has gotten us to a place of sheer absurdity.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, George Orwell in 1984 wrote about one of the cores of totalitarianism is compelling people to say things that they know aren't true, but to claim them as true, like 2 + 2 = 5. Well, our version of 2 + 2 = 5 is that someone with male genitalia is a woman if he claims he is. Now, if you won't say this, in some places, you'll lose your job. I interviewed in Live Not By Lies a physician at a major American hospital. He would only talk to me if I promised not to use his name or identify his hospital. He was born in the Soviet Union, but didn't become a Christian until he got to America. He said that at his hospital, that all the physicians have been ordered, if anybody shows up and they want cross-sex hormones or want cross-sex hormones for their children, we have to give it to them, even if it goes against your best judgment as a doctor. We're not talking about moral judgment. We're talking about clinical judgment, because not everybody who has gender dysphoria, you know, it needs to have hormones. I would say no one does. But anyway, just from a purely medical point of view, sometimes it's something that can be worked through psychologically without this sort of extraordinary intervention. But for political reasons, the hospital said this must be the case. And this doctor was telling me, there have been other testimonies about this too, that within American medicine, if you deny whatever the transgenders claim and their allies claim, then you are a bigot and you will be fired. And it has happened to some very prominent people, including the head of a transgender clinic in Toronto a few years ago, a man who is not a religious man at all. He just made the mistake of saying that surgical intervention and hormonal intervention is not always the best thing for people with gender dysphoria. The transgender activist wouldn't stop until he was fired from the clinic that he founded himself. This is totalitarianism, straight up.
Yeah, and you find this in the media, you find it in academia, you find it in corporate America in general. And as you write about in the book, you are sort of compelled to go along with absurdities like men have periods, fathers can give birth, the man standing in front of you is called she. Diversity and inclusion means excluding those who object to ideological uniformity. Equity means treating people unequally, and the list goes on.
Yeah, it does. And this is what I mean by soft totalitarianism. I mean, none of this, Hank, is coming to us from a dictatorial state. I mean, it's true that under President Obama, he, toward the end of his second term, he sent down an edict from the Education Department ordering public schools to allow students to participate in the sports and the locker rooms of their preferred gender. President Trump overturned that. I think we can expect that when President Biden takes over, that he will reinstate it. But in any case, this is all going to end up before the Supreme Court. But that's one case where the state is involved there. But all this stuff is happening without the state compelling it. Universities are choosing to do it. The media now, I mean, the Associated Press rewrites its style book to conform to politically correct agenda. And this is one thing, too, that Americans just didn't see coming. Big business is doing this as well. It has been shocking this year to me to see how in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests and riots, so many major corporations have fallen all over themselves to take up so-called anti-racism, which is an Orwellian term if there ever was one, because the anti-racism ideology, as promulgated by Ibram Kendi, its big guru, it says that everything in life is racial and must be seen as racial. So when you encounter a phenomenon, a social phenomenon, you're not supposed to ask, is there racism here? You're actually supposed to ask, how does racism manifest itself in this situation? Well, this, again, is the way totalitarianism works. A totalitarian system is one, most basically, in which every aspect of life is politicized. This is why, Hank, you can have totalitarianism within a liberal democracy. And that's what we're seeing. There's a story I tell in the book about in the early Soviet period, the Soviet Chess Society could see that the government was trying to politicize chess. And they wanted to protect chess. And they put out a statement saying, we need to stand for chess's sake. You know, keep politics out of it. A commissar wrote to them and said, no, 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 comrades. At the time of the revolution, everything is for the sake of the revolution. Let there be no more chess for chess's sake. Everything is for the revolution's sake. We're repeating that ourselves because we have never learned that history.
You mentioned Black Lives Matter. Can you help people perhaps make a dichotomy between the movement itself and the moniker? It seems to me that you can affirm the idea of Black Lives Matter, but the idea of the movement itself is an idea that is fraught with all kinds of problems, including the disruption of the nuclear family. And the co-founders talk about being trained Marxists.
They do. It's the most amazing thing. But of course, this too has not been reported by the media, even though you can find it easily on the internet in their own words. They're not trying to deny it. Black Lives Matter as a movement started maybe 7 years ago. I think it was after the Trayvon Martin death. And what it tries to do, you know, and this is why I think so many people are favorable toward it without really knowing what the whole movement means, is it's saying, look, Black people are not expendable. We believe, say the leaders, that in this society, people don't think that Black lives matter. And we want to stand up and say they do, and let's take a stand for them. That's something, it's put as simple as that, that all Christians, everybody ought to be able to affirm that Black lives are not worth less than anybody else's lives. The problem is with this movement, if you go to their website, you can see this clearly. They are intersectionalist. This is the Marxist critical theory that says that all forms of oppression, as the Marxists define them, are linked. So this is why the Black Lives Matter movement officially is in favor of disrupting the nuclear family. They believe that the nuclear family is a factory for oppression and that all forms of oppression must be overturned. So a lot of people who say they're for Black Lives Matter because they're for racial justice, they may not understand that they are being co-opted into something that is anti-Christian and really, really destructive of the basics of liberal democracy.
Expand on the subtle, seductive temptation to live a lie in the workplace in order to survive, to be willing to accept without protest the propaganda that the state is telling you to affirm.
Well, and in our case, again, it's not even the state at this point. I can remember, probably shouldn't get too personal there, but let's just say I have had the same experience as many of my readers of my blog, of being in the workplace in which we were all expected to go along with diversity training. Well, you know, that nobody wants to or should want to be hostile to people of different races and so forth. That's fine, but that's not what this is. It's a form of ideological indoctrination. But you go along with it because you don't want to say anything about it. You don't want to question the premises because you know that if you raise your hand and say, wait, I don't think this is true. I don't agree with this theory that I'm a racist just because I'm white. You know that if you do that, you'll be marked out and you'll be denied promotions and you may eventually be kicked out of the company. So you keep your mouth shut and just decide I'm going to go along to get along. And I'll just keep myself untainted by this. All of us have had to do this one way or the other at some point in our working lives. But if you keep doing this long enough, you become the lie yourself. In my book, I talk about what this famous Polish intellectual, Czesław Miłosz, he defected from Poland in the 1950s, and he wrote a very powerful book called The Captive Mind, in which he tries to explain communism and why intellectuals fell for communism, to explain it to a Western audience. And Hank, he says in there that a lot of people in the West don't understand that communism does not just work by intimidating people into believing it or affirming it. It also promises people a sense of harmony and a sense of purpose in life. There are a lot of people who maybe don't have God anymore, or who they do have God, but their feelings about God are shaky. They're really drawn to this sort of thing because it gives them a sense of meaning and a sense of harmony and communion with their fellow man. But he goes on to say that some people who are so desperate to feel this sense of harmony are willing to accept all kinds of lies in exchange for that feeling of harmony. But it can get to a point where they have to practice what he calls ketman, K-E-T-M-A-N. It's a Persian word meaning official hypocrisy, to be two-faced. And so someone who practices ketman says, I'm going to go into the workplace, I'm going to pretend that I'm going along with this, but deep down I'm going to reject it, but I just don't want any trouble. Well, if you do that long enough, as Miłosz says, you eventually become the lie itself. You think that you have not been corrupted by it, but in fact you have, and you'll lose the ability to have any sense of moral courage or discernment. That's why one of the great stories that I tell in the book is came not from an interview, but from reading the work of dissident literature. Václav Havel, the first president of a free Czechoslovakia, was not a believer, but he was a humanist, and he led the Czech dissident movement. He wrote a long essay called The Power of the Powerless back in 1977. And like Solzhenitsyn in his Live Not by Lies essay that came out 3 years earlier, Václav Havel said, look, we don't have any power here to overturn the totalitarian regime, but we can refuse to live by lies. And Havel told the story of a fictional story of a greengrocer under communism. He, like every other shopkeeper under communism, has to put a sign up in the window that says, workers of the world, unite, which is the Marxist slogan. Nobody believes it, but everybody puts it in their window because they don't want trouble from the government. They just want to be seen as conformists. Well, what happens, says Havel, if one day the little greengrocer says, I'm not going to play along with this anymore. I'm not putting the sign up in my window. Well, the secret police come around. He loses his shop. His kids aren't able to go to university. He loses his privileges and so on and so forth. He really suffers for the stance he's taken. But because he is willing to suffer for the truth, he shows that the truth is something real. And he demonstrates to others who see this happen that it is possible to refuse to go along with this situation and continue to exist. You're going to have to suffer for it, but at least you have your integrity. And if enough people live like that, said Havel, then the system will have to change. That is what Solzhenitsyn said, and that, Hank, is what I'm saying that we all have to start doing in this country now. We're not facing gulags and prison camps and so forth, but the stranglehold of this political ideology is tightening around all of our necks with each passing day, and we have got to be prepared to suffer in some meaningful way for our faith and for the truth, or we're all going to collapse.
Yeah, I want to pause for just a second and let everybody listening in know that your book, Live Not by Lies, A Manual for Christian Dissidents, is available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Your copy available for your support on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. I love this book, and I love this book. When I'm in the position of having to read so many books each week, so many articles, so many blogs, to digest so much information, when I say I really love a book, I mean I really love a book. And I think this is a book that you can read and grasp. And one of the reasons you can do that is Rod so powerfully uses the power of story. He's a master at it. And you can tell by the dialogue we're having right now. So it's not just logical truth propositions that are ethereal that you can't get your mind around, but rather stories that take those logical truth propositions and make them real to you because they're forged in the cauldron of real life. Anyway, this book is fabulous, available for those of you who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Check it out on the web at equip.org. You know, what I'm talking about here, Rod, is you're not only communicating these logical truth propositions using the power of story, but you're also giving us what your subtitle talks about, a manual for Christian dissidents. In other words, you're not just cursing the darkness, you're lighting a candle in the midst of the growing darkness. Maybe not just a candle. I mean, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. So you don't take the light and put it under a bushel. You put it on a stand, gives light to everybody in the house, as Jesus said. And this is what you're doing. You're giving us a way forward in the midst of not something that's coming, but something that's already here.
That's right. And I think, Hank, the most important lesson of this book, and these aren't just lessons from me, these are lessons from my interviews with people, with Christians, Catholics, Protestants, and Orthodox Christians who suffered through real communism. And it's advice they're giving us for how we can start building an interior stance of resistance and start doing practical things in our lives and ourselves and our families and our churches and so forth to get ready for what's coming. But the most important lesson they've taught me, Hank, is that we have to be willing to suffer. We have to learn how to suffer. I remember standing about a year ago on a street in Moscow near the Kremlin talking to an elderly Baptist man, a white-haired gentleman named Yuri Sipko. Now, in Russia, the Baptists have it really rough. Our people, the Orthodox people, have not been kind to them over the years. And Yuri Sipko grew up in a Baptist community, and I think they were in Siberia. And all the men were taken away by Stalin to the prison camps. The women had to raise their children to be faithful in horrible, horrible times. Anyway, Yuri Sipko had told me stories that his community went through and ways that they had to learn how to be real disciples under persecution. And he told me standing out in the street after our interview that I needed to go back home to America and tell the church, you've got to be prepared to suffer, that if you are not prepared to suffer and even die for Jesus Christ, then your faith is nothing but hypocrisy. And he even told me that in Russia, some of the evangelicals of the younger generation are now going back to take up the ways of life of their ancestors who lived that way under communism because they have seen what capitalism and liberty that has become licensed to be, to lust, licensed to be worldly. They've seen what it has done to people, and they know that if they're going to hold on to the faith, they're going to have to live in strongly countercultural ways, even though communism ended 30 years ago. That was just a striking thing for me to learn.
Do you think COVID-19 is a quintessential example of how easily we can give up our liberties within this milieu, within this last 10 months? It seems like we are progressively willing to give up not only liberties, but common sense itself.
You know, this is a hard question for me. It's one I've been thinking about a lot, because when COVID first came, like most other Christians, I was upset by the fact that we couldn't go to church, although our bishops and the Orthodox Church in America changed eventually and let us start coming back to church in limited numbers. But I was really upset by it and didn't want to do any of this. But I did it because I have a weak immune system and I didn't want to put myself and my family at risk. But I had to stop and think, Hank, about the lessons I had learned from men and women who had been to prison in the communist period, how they got through prison. I fell back on this man, I tell his story in Live Not by Lies, Dr. Sylvester Krcmary. He was a Slovak physician, a young man who was part of Father Kolakovich's family. And the secret police pulled him off the streets in 1951, threw him in a car to take him to prison. And he writes in his memoir that he laughed at the secret police because he knew that finally he was going to be given a chance, he, Dr. Krcmary, to share in Christ's suffering. And he said, I realize that this ought to be something rightly that brings me joy. And it made the secret police so angry. Anyway, Dr. Krcmary wrote about how when he was put into prison at the beginning, he had to resolve that he was never going to feel sorry for himself. He rather saw himself as God's probe, as trying to learn what he could from the prison experience so he could deepen his own conversion and extend the kingdom and to minister to other people in prison. So this is how he got through 10 years of prison, by seeing it as a chance to grow spiritually. And it wasn't just an abstraction for him. This was a man who was being tortured, and yet he knew that he could not let himself hate his torturers or the devil would win. Well, thinking about us in COVID sitting on the couch watching Netflix, it's not the same thing as a communist prison, but the principle is there. The idea that, we have to look at what's happening to us and try to understand where the blessing might be in it. And that was a really hard thing to do. But I think that there's definitely been some cases in some states where the state has clearly overreached. I'm thinking of California in particular, where people can't go to church, but they could go to other secular places. But for me, the main lesson from the COVID thing has been learning how to abide without losing our peace. Yes, we need to stand up when our liberties are being unreasonably taken away from us, unreasonably challenged. But if we're going to fight this in the long term, fight this soft totalitarianism, we're going to have to learn how to be still and know that God is in control and not be discouraged by what's happening to us, not allow ourselves to be overtaken by fear or anger, because that will just unhorse us right there.
Yeah, beautiful. I mentioned I want to get back to the Bolsheviks, which you talked about earlier on. So here you have in 1917, a revolution led by an angry Bolshevik named Vladimir Lenin. And he, in the process of this revolution, proves that under certain circumstances, you can have a dedicated minority gaining absolute power over the masses, and partly because the masses are indifferent. And today we have what happened in 1917 memorialized in song by another Lenin in 1971. So it's imagining something that we don't know that much about, because as you say, people don't even know oftentimes what a gulag is when you talk about it.
No, they don't. You know, when I was in Moscow doing my interviews there, at the end of my interviews, I'd spent the past 3 or 4 days talking to men who had, some of them had been tortured in prison, who had seen massacres, all kinds of things. It was just horrifying. I went to dinner that last night at the home of a Russian Orthodox family, just an ordinary family living in an apartment in suburban Moscow. And I made the mistake, although I guess it wasn't really a mistake, but I said early in the conversation, I just don't understand how anybody in Russia could have fallen for what the Bolsheviks were preaching. Well, the father at the end of the table looked at me and said, "You don't understand? Well, let me tell you." And he goes back to the 17th century and starts telling about the long history of Russia and the way the poor and the peasantry were mistreated, exploited, put into serfdom, and so on and so forth. And he gets up to the late 19th century, early 20th century. He said, by the time the Bolsheviks came along, people were so fed up with everything they had been put through that they were willing to believe anything that offered them relief. He said, the Bolsheviks were wrong. I mean, this was an Orthodox Christian. He said, but you can see where they came from, because so many people in power in that society had become indifferent to the cries of the poor and the oppressed. And this, the man was trying to help me understand, this is something that we have to be aware of, too, as Christians trying to fight soft totalitarianism, that if we allow social injustice and suffering to go on without being addressed, then we open up the space for angry extremists who know what they believe and who will exploit the suffering of people to get their power. One of the things, too, that we need to take for the Bolshevik example is the power of elites. You know, in Russia, the Marxists had been working for decades to try to get a revolution going and had gotten nowhere until the 1890s. There was a great famine in Russia in 1891-92. The Tsarist government did a terrible job of famine relief. And that was the first time that most ordinary people, or people in the middle classes at least, began to wonder, you know what, maybe this system is bad. Maybe what the Marxists are saying has some truth to it. Also at that time, the intellectuals became completely obsessed with Marxism. The artists became obsessed with Marxism. And a lot of people, this is something really interesting, a lot of people wanted so badly to stay in touch with their children that when their children became Marxist, they went along with it. They didn't become Marxists themselves, but they at least became neutral on the question of Marxism. And eventually, Lenin seized power after the system collapsed after the First World War. Lenin seized power not because he represented a majority of people, but because he had the elites on his side. Similarly, in this country, this is one thing I want people to understand, is that even though most people, most of the listeners of this podcast, probably the people they know in their lives don't go in for critical race theory or transgenderism or anything like that, but it doesn't matter because the elite culture in America has already bought into this. The gatekeepers into the professions, medicine, law, corporate executives, media, and so on and so forth, they do believe in this stuff, and they will not let people into those elite circles if they don't affirm it themselves. And this is something that you will not see written about or broadcast on the media, not because they're trying to hide it necessarily, but because they already accept it as right and normal and good. So if we ourselves, we Christians, we who want to live by the truth and live faithfully, we're going to have to make the call one day. Are we willing to sacrifice middle-class professional success and access to the cultural elites for the sake of our faith? It's going to be that stark. And I'm afraid that given the fact that so much of American Christianity has not been about living counterculturally, but rather baptizing middle-class preferences, that a lot of us are not going to pass that test when it's put to us.
Yeah, and you note in your book, and you've talked about this extensively at other forums as well, that there are parallels between a declining U.S. and the pre-revolutionary Russia. In fact, these parallels are unnervingly close.
Definitely. The collapse of faith in institutions was a big one. I just talked a little bit about that. The collapse of the artistic and literary elite into lasciviousness, into sexual radicalism was a big one. I was astonished to learn in reading one history of the Russian Revolution that around 1905 and thereabouts, Satan himself became an icon for the artistic elite because they saw him as an individualist and as the first rebel. So you had people, they didn't believe that Satan was real, but they saw him as an iconic figure. And these are things that are happening now all around us. We had a guy that came to our church a couple of years ago, a young man, to our Orthodox church here in Baton Rouge, where I live, and he had come out of an occult circle here in the city, Aleister Crowley, you know, the dread magician of the early 20th century. It was part of Crowley's sex magic religion. And this young man, he had been saved out of it and wanted to know peace and to know Christ. And I remember him telling me that the things that they used to look forward to, that Aleister Crowley had prophesied would happen in the future once the world accepted Lucifer, these were things that were already happening now and were considered totally mainstream, especially the sexualization of all things. Well, this is what it was like in pre-revolutionary Russia, this radical decadence. And it's absolutely shocking to see it happening around us right now. Christians cannot miss the signs of the times. And if I could say too, Hank, that I write in the book about how Hannah Arendt, who's one of the great political theorists of the 20th century, she wrote a book in the early 50s called The Origins of Totalitarianism. In this book, she examined Nazi Germany and communist Russia to try to figure out what it was about the social conditions in both places that allowed totalitarianism to conquer these great nations. And she came up with a list of pre-totalitarian characteristics. I won't go into all of it right here, but I do say in the book that the main thing that both Russia and Germany had in common before totalitarianism took over was mass loneliness, that people had become atomized from each other. Their faith in the church, their faith in the institutions of their society and their government had been shattered, and they didn't know where to turn. Their totalitarianism spoke to them in their loneliness and offered them a sense of brotherhood and a purpose and meaning. It was all a lie. It was a Nazi lie and it was a communist lie, but it spoke to felt needs of mass man. It was also the case there that people had stopped knowing who they could trust, and they had started believing that what was true was what felt right to them. They didn't care if it was provably false. If it felt right to them, they accepted it as true. The abandonment of a search for truth and the confidence that truth can be known is a precursor to totalitarianism. Now, if you don't see that happening in our society right now, then you're absolutely blind.
It's kind of counterintuitive, though, because you have Marx pontificating that what he was espousing was based in science, and you have government constantly saying the very same thing today, that they follow science. But all the while, they seem to be completely denigrating the very tenets of the scientific method, which really constitutes questioning rather than capitulating.
Yeah, it's all ideological. You know, it's all an ideological game. I think one of the most important lectures I ever heard in my life came about 12 years ago. I was at Cambridge in England and heard a historian, Dame Gillian Beer, talk about how Darwinism was taken up in the 19th century by different political factions in Victorian England. She said the imperialist took Darwin's findings and said, see, this just goes to show that science proves that the British are destined to rule the world because the survival of the fittest, the strongest always conquer, etc. She said the abolitionist, on the other hand, said, see, this just goes to show that we are all brothers deep down and that racism is wrong. Science proves it, and so on and so forth. Dame Gillian's point was simply that scientific knowledge is deeply contested, and we should not accept it when people say, well, the science shows this, because people, even without knowing what they're doing, they construe as scientific fact things that aren't really scientifically factual, but rather just a rationalization for their own political beliefs.
You know, truth is on the altar in general. In your book, you talk about the New York Times 1619 Project. and the core claims of this project that the Patriots fought Revolutionary War to preserve slavery. So you have a myth that's being perpetuated in thousands of classrooms, really, around the country. And if you listen to these myths long enough, your whole mind becomes disoriented. I was thinking the other day about something that happened this year. I was looking at some material for Christopher Columbus Day. And so I went to the web and I started Googling. And I went through pages and pages and pages. And all the pages were the exact same narrative. The narrative turns out to be a distortion of what Columbus actually wrote in documents and diaries. And the distortion is made with ellipses. So it's a distortion of ellipses, ellipses improperly used. And the same thing's going on with this 1619 project, revising America's national identity by making race hatred, as you alluded to earlier, central to the nation's founding.
That's right. And that is an example I cite in the book of people willing to believe things that are lies because it suits our ideological preferences. This is something that the New York Times launched, gosh, I guess over a year ago, but saying that trying to challenge, and the word they use is reframe American history, not around the Declaration of Independence, but chattel slavery. And they stated, as you've just explained, that actually America was founded for the sole purpose of defending chattel slavery. Well, when that came out, we had left-wing historians, including Sean Willens at Princeton, say, this is not true. You know, of course, we had slavery when the Declaration was signed and the Constitution was signed, and we eventually had to fight a civil war to sort that out. But America was not founded for the sake of preserving slavery. This is a lie. Well, it's a lie that's gone very far. The woman who was behind the project, Nicole Hannah Jones, won the Pulitzer Prize for this lie. As you said, it's now in thousands of elementary schools. The Pulitzer Center has pushed this onto elementary schools. Oprah Winfrey and movie studios signed a big deal with the 1619 Project founders to make pop culture about it. This is how history is being taught and will be taught to future generations who, if they accept this as being real history, will suddenly see all of American life and the American founding as evil, as illegitimate. That is the precursor to revolution. There's no two ways about it.
Before I forget, I want you to talk for a moment about the image on the cover of your book. It's intriguing. It's also very instructive.
Right. You know, whenever you write a book, usually the cover art is something that the author works out with the art department at the publisher. I had several versions of this cover come to me by the art department, and they all look like kind of a generic inspirational book. And I said, that's not what this book is about. This book is about taking the experiences of people fighting communism in the communist bloc, but doing so, taking these experiences and making them work for Christians in the here and now. And I told them that I wanted to use Soviet expressionist art. Soviet expressionist art was a form of illustration that the Soviets used in their propaganda posters early on in the revolution because they wanted the revolution to seem very modern and fresh, very, very striking art. Well, I asked them to take that style and create a cover out of it, make it look like a Soviet propaganda poster. And that's what they've done. On the cover of the book, you see a church that is tilting, a church facade tilting at an angle, and the figure of a man pushing uphill, carrying a cross uphill. And then you see the title, Live Not by Lies. The idea here is to take Soviet propaganda motif, but repurpose it for Christian use. I think it's really striking. It's in black and red. I've had some people who lived under communism, immigrants to this country, say they didn't like it because it caused them to feel a sense of chill. But I wanted it to convey to American readers, and I think it does this, that this is about something really urgent and active. This is not about, here's something gentle for you to read to sort of bliss you out spiritually. This is a call to action.
Yeah, urgent, active, and axiomatic. How does the phrase, the personal is political, capture the totalitarian ethos?
As I said earlier, the essence of totalitarianism is a society where everything has been politicized. We might consider it in distinction with authoritarianism, which is a society in which one party or a political figure, a dictator, has monopolized political power in the society, but the rest of society he leaves alone. In totalitarianism, everything about your personal life has been made political too. So totalitarianism tries to get down into your thoughts. So whenever you think about anything in your personal life, you have to think about it in light of the particular governing ideology. We see that happening now, I'm afraid, when so many of these anti-racism training, things like that, diversity training that we get, train people to police themselves constantly for ideological nonconformity. And so you get to the place where you're doing the work of the state yourself and policing yourself. Similarly, when we were talking earlier in our discussion, Hank, about the social credit system in China, the social credit system looks at every single thing you do online, even things that have absolutely nothing to do with politics. It considers them to be political because it helps predict the sort of person you are. And they punish or reward people on the basis of their personal non-political choices. In the same way here, whenever all this data that our companies collect from us by our web browsing and things like that, they're doing it just to sell us things, to send us ads that appeal to our interests and so on and so forth. But it's very easy to take that same data and politicize it. I tell a story in the book about sitting in an apartment in Prague of Kamila Bendova. Kamila and her husband, Václav, were the only practicing Christians in the inner circle of Václav Havel's movement. And her husband died in 1999, but Kamila's still there. And I noticed as we were doing our interview about the Christian resistance movement, I noticed she had a dumb phone sitting next to her. And I said, Kamila, why don't you have a smartphone that's connected to the internet? She looked at me and said, this is something I do not understand, why so many people today are willing to give over so much of their personal information for free on the internet. She said, if you've lived through what we live through, you know that there is no such thing as the innocent collection of this kind of information. Sooner or later, it will be used against you. You can say, well, I've not done anything wrong. They can't use it against me. That's beside the point. She said, if they want to get you and punish you, they'll configure a way to use this information to condemn you. And I thought about this, about how back home in America, I was sitting there with my smartphone. I use it. Back home in America, we even have people with Alexas in their house, the smart speakers. And I thought if you had somebody from the federal government show up at your door and say, hi, we'd like to put this speaker in your house that will listen to the conversations in your house, but don't worry, it'll make it easier for you to order things and have a more convenient life. You would slam the door on that guy from the government. But if it's sold to us by Amazon as solely a consumer convenience, not only will we put these things in our house, but we'll pay for the privilege.
Yeah. Talk about what separates the communist, the hard communist regime from classical liberals. So how are socialists today and communists distinct from classical liberals?
Well, I'm not sure what hard form socialism has taken today in the post-Cold War era, but historically, they don't believe in individual rights and liberties. They believe in class conflict and that, as we were talking earlier, social justice is a matter of class interest. And justice is, for the communist, what is good for the working class. Now, you can argue about whether or not it really is good for the working class, but that's how they see it. In liberal society, we believe in the sanctity, at least on paper, of the individual. We believe that there are rights that individuals have that precede government and that can't be abrogated. This is why we have in our U.S. Constitution, you have the First Amendment, the right to freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. These are things that our Constitution recognizes as God-given, not given by the government, but given by God and recognized by the government. None of this makes sense at all to communists and socialists who believe rather that there's no such thing as the sacred individual. But as I said earlier, that, you know, that we only have value as members of a social class or a racial identity group.
I'm thinking about something I heard as you were just speaking. In fact, it was a clip that I played on the air a month or two ago. It was by Kamala Harris, who was contrasting equality with equity and concluding that the government needs to ensure both. And I think the takeaway statement of this clip, as I recall it, and I'm pretty sure this is exactly what she said, is that equitable treatment means we all end up in the same place. And it was not just a slogan, but in context, she was arguing for this.
I see what you mean. Yeah, you're exactly right. That under a communist system, you know, we won't have social justice as long as people are unequal. And this is whenever you hear people, the social justice warriors, talking about equity instead of equality, I think most of us hear equity and think, oh, that's just a different word for equality. That's not what they mean. We all believe in equality as liberals, classical liberals, in the sense that we believe everyone is equal before the law and that everybody should have as much as possible equal opportunities to succeed or to fail. That's not what equity means. Equity means not only that we start out as equal before the law, but we must be materially equal too. And if they have to take away wealth from people to make everybody materially equal, or take away opportunities and liberties to succeed in the workplace and give it to people who are members of a group that has not succeeded in the numbers that the state wants, then they're going to do that because they don't believe there's any such thing as individual rights.
Talk about how serious the mistake is of mocking left-wing radicals with monikers like snowflakes.
Well, I think that it's something that I've done myself. You know, you call them snowflakes and tell them that, oh, you just melt at the first heat, and, you know, that you treat them like they're wimpy. But the thing is, this is the way to power. One, and I think I talk about this in Live Not By Lies, one of the most important events of the last decade happened with some snowflakes, so-called snowflakes, on the Yale University campus in 2015, around Halloween of 2015. Your listeners might remember, around that time, one of the professors, she and her husband, the Christakises were their name. The Christakises were like house parents in one of the residential colleges there, and both of them are professors at Yale. Yale University sent out a memo to all the students saying nobody should wear Halloween costumes that offend anybody else. Well, Erica Christakis, the wife, sent out a memo responding to that to the students in her house saying, is this really what a university should be doing? Should busy itself telling young adults what they can and can't wear as a Halloween costume. Now, in my generation, Hank, and in your generation, students would have said, yeah, stand up for us. Don't let the man tell us what to do. But in this generation that was in college right now, they turned on Erica Christakis viciously, accused her of not caring about them, making fun of their anxieties, and so on and so forth. You can go on YouTube and see an argument that her husband, Nicholas Christakis, had on the square outside their college. He was arguing with this mob of students. He, I should say, is a baby boomer, white-haired man, a white man of Greek descent, but he's engaging this group, which had become a very emotional mob, mostly students of color, trying to dialogue with them rationally about the issue. He was listening to them and offering counter-arguments and trying to engage them. They weren't having any of it, Hank. They screamed at him. They cursed him viciously. They wept. They cried. They behaved like snowflakes. They behaved in a way that my generation and yours would have been ashamed of doing back on our campuses. But it worked there. Their tears got the Yale University administration to side with them against the Christakises. And Erica Christakis left Yale. She doesn't teach at Yale anymore. What's so important about this childish juvenile behavior actually works in this society, in elite society, to motivate those who govern access to power and the exercise of power to compel them to do what the weepers want. So you can call them snowflakes if you want, but what they do is very, very powerful. And within a culture, and elite cultures like this, where victimization is the key to gaining and exercising power.
I hope you can take a few moments here, Rod, to take some of the words and phrases that you use in the book and get people conversant with what you're talking about. For example, you talk about the myth of progress. And there's certainly a sense in which, from a Christian perspective, we talk about progress. We talk about going from glory to glory with unveiled face. In other words, there's a progression in the Christian life. It's not punctiliar, but we're progressing toward a goal that's ultimately unreachable because we want union with the ineffable, and that's something we can never attain, but we're always moving towards that. So there's a sense of progress within Christianity, but there's also a myth of progress. What's the difference?
Well, you know, within Christianity, history becomes linear. You know, we know that we are progressing towards the second coming and the culmination of history. We know that history is not circular as it was in ancient religions, but linear. So that's where the basic idea of historical progress came. But it has been used, taken up by the Enlightenment and by the Marxists, to mean progressing more and more towards a state where man is more scientific and has shaken off the chains of the past, whether it's tradition, religion, anything that keeps man from exercising his will. And that is called progress. So progressives today wish to eliminate even gender, use technology to eliminate the idea of male and female. And this is called progress. And anything that stands in the way of that, anything that insists on limits, is considered an obstacle to progress. The reason I call it the myth of progress is because you see this all the time whenever anybody, any Christian or any conservative, speaks out against one of these innovations, that you hear people on the left say, you can't turn back the clock. President Obama said, I remember when Obergefell was passed by the Supreme Court, President Obama talked about the arc of history bends in a moral direction. I forget the exact phrase. The idea is that all of history is inevitably leading in one direction, and it is towards liberty, individual liberty. Now, Marx took this and said that all of history is leading inevitably to communism, right? But we, and as children of the Enlightenment in America, we've come to believe that all of history is leading ultimately to liberal democracy all over the world. I heard just last week a prominent Christian broadcaster saying that, you know, we need to make sure that America stays strong so we can continue bringing freedom and democracy all over the world. I mean, this is a classical liberal idea of progress. Now, I've probably gone too deep into the weeds on this, Hank, but I think that it's really important that your listeners understand to question this. Whenever you hear progress and the inevitability of progress being preached by people on the left, and to talk about how we're progressing when we throw away moral prohibitions and religion and things like that, that this is an ideological construct. You know, I tell the story in the book about how people who were raised under communism, they were propagandized constantly by the government to look on all the traditions that had been handed to them, the folkways, the religion, things like that, as obstacles to progress, as things that had to be left behind so humankind could become what it is meant to be. I tell the story about Tamás Shai. He's a professor of the English language in Budapest, talking about how all the movies and TV they got growing up under communism demonized everything in the past, all in the name of progress.
Some of what you have written in the book is just rhetorically delicious. Here's something I'm quoting from the book. I underlined it about three times in four different colors. But it's where you say, under the rubric of a pink police state, which I'd love you to define, a pink police state, powerful corporate and state actors are controlling masses of people by massaging them with digital velvet gloves. and by convincing them to surrender their liberties for security and convenience. That's a mouthful. There's a lot inculcated in that in that deliciously rhetorical statement.
Well, the phrase pink police state, I wish I could say it was my own, but it was coined by a contemporary critic named James Polos. And he has written about it online. You can look it up if you just Google pink police state. But by pink, he means, well, it's another way of saying soft totalitarianism. He believes, as I said, that people will prefer to give up liberty, to give up freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, for the sake of a state that guarantees them access to things like pot and pornography and sexual expression and so on and so forth, that they're not going to mind living in a place where we have fewer freedoms as long as the things that give them pleasure are guaranteed and advanced. And, you know, this is Brave New World. Exactly. This is the future that Aldous Huxley saw in the 1920s when he wrote that book that we were headed to. You know, if we no longer believe that there's anything outside of ourselves, that the highest level of human experience is personal pleasure, then this is what we will use technology to create. And I fear that we're headed there now. You know, with pornography is one thing that just knocks my socks off. Whenever I go to colleges to talk, especially the Christian colleges, I always ask campus ministers and professors, what are the challenges you're seeing among the students? What is the thing that vexes them the most, and so forth? And it's always pornography, always. Campus ministers and professors tell me that it is hard to overstate how thoroughly pornography and addiction to pornography has conquered the minds of young people. I even went to this one Christian college, and I spoke to the campus minister who had a particular study group of young men who were planning to enter seminary after they got their undergraduate degree. These were evangelicals. And he said, there's 16 young men in this group. Do you know how many, Rod, are addicted to pornography? By which he meant were using pornography compulsively and couldn't stop, though they wanted to stop. I said, maybe half. He said, 16. He said, this is not unusual. This is what has happened today. This is what technology has enabled. And this is what not only technology has enabled, but a culture that doesn't know how to say no has enabled.
You know, we've only scratched the surface, but I want to get to at least a few comments about part two of your book, because it's so important. You talk about how to live in truth, which is the antidote to soft totalitarianism. And I was pondering some of the verses in the Wisdom of Sirach, and I came across Sirach 4:28, which says, fight to the death for the truth, and the Lord God will fight for you. And, you know, again, I thought about that maxim when I saw your chapter heading, I think it's chapter 5, value nothing more than truth, or the Russian proverb, one word of truth outweighs the whole world, or truth is so obscure in these times and falsehood so established that unless you love the truth, you cannot know it. So the importance of truth.
Right. This is something that I discovered. I didn't have it in mind before I went over there. I just sat down and asked people about the things that helped them resist. And all of them said in one way or the other that it was believing that truth wasn't something that was solely individual, but that there existed outside of ourselves something, an objective reality. For all the Christians, of course, that was rooted in God. But what this meant to them in their daily lives, and especially in their confrontations with the authorities, was knowing that truth existed and it could be known, and that what was being told to them was a lie. And here's something really interesting about that. I remember when I was in Prague talking to members of the Benda family. The Bendas, Václav and Kamila, had six children. They're all adults now and have kids of their own. But they raised these six kids not only to be dissidents under communism, but also to be faithful Catholics. And this was something really remarkable because in what's now the Czech Republic, it's the most atheistic country in Europe. And it's very hard to find Christians there. But the adult Benda children and their children are all practicing Christians. So I asked Camilla, the mom, I said, look, how did you and your husband do this? You raised these kids to know what was true and what was false in this under communism, but you also kept them in the faith. How did you do it? Well, the dad was the one, Václav, who took the lead in teaching them about what was happening out in the world and how to spot lies in school and, you know, in their daily life outside the house. But home life was Camilla's domain, and she told me that even when her husband, Václav, was sent to prison as a political prisoner, and she had to keep working to keep food on the table for the kids, she always took 2 hours a day to read to her children. And it didn't matter how tired she was, she would read to them. And I could believe it, too, because standing there in her apartment, I mean, it was just like 14-foot ceilings in this apartment, and there were books on every wall, all the way from floor to ceiling. And I said, well, Camilla, what did you read to them? She said, well, I read to them myths, I read to them classics of literature, and I read to them Tolkien. I said, well, why Tolkien? She looked at me right in the eyes and said, because we knew that Mordor was real. And she went on to explain, Hank, that she knew that for kids, kids couldn't understand all the abstractions behind communism and, you know, what they were fighting against in that way, but they could understand the story. And she likened what she and her husband and all their friends, their adult friends, were doing to what Frodo and the Fellowship of the Ring were doing. And that was something the kids were able to understand. And what Camilla wanted me to get to was it's not enough to teach kids how to identify truth and lies out in the world. You also have to build their moral imaginations with truth, goodness, and beauty in the form of good literature and art. That was something that I was not expecting, but this is all part of being able to discern the truth and to stand for the truth. Because if you don't have these sort of things built into your moral imagination and the moral imagination of your children, you're not going to have what it takes to resist.
Yeah, you get the importance of teaching our children the difference between truth and propaganda, but also, as you write about, the significance of cultivating cultural memory. I was struck by the fact that you underscore or note that a relatively low percentage of millennials, and I suppose Generation Z, believe that the Declaration of Independence offers a better guarantee for freedom and equity than does the Communist Manifesto.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah, this was from a survey done by the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, a foundation established by the U.S. Congress to keep the story of what happened in those countries alive. And they are seeing year in and year out, as we move further and further from the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, they're seeing a functional memory of what happened fade away. And, you know, it's like the 26-year-old I talked about who decided communism was a great idea but knew nothing about the gulags. This has gone from the cultural memory of her generation. It was never given to them because it was not preserved by my generation, right, and passed on to these kids. So I think kids learn how students in this culture learn that history is nothing but facts, and we should only pay attention to the facts that help us get what we want, whether it's just regurgitate answers so we'll get a good score on a test and get our diploma and get a good job, or whether it's just something that we want to learn because it gives us pleasure or a sense of meaning. Very few people today believe that we should know certain things for reasons that may not be immediately apparent to us, but because our culture has decided these things are important to know. We've given that up now in exchange for pure ideology.
The criticality of cultural memory is one thing. Something else that you point out and underscore is the importance of memory in general. And when I read that, I resonated with it immediately because memory is just part of my DNA. I've been memorizing scripture and memorizing all kinds of things, which has prepared me for doing what I do at the Christian Research Institute. And you're talking about the significance of memorization in light of the coming persecution or persecution that's taking place already.
Right. I tell a story in the book from Dr. Sylvester Krucmary, who was put into the Czechoslovak prison system for his Christian faith. He talked about how important it proved to him to have memorized scripture because they weren't allowed to have Bibles in prison. And because he had memorized the scripture, he could not only draw on that for his own comfort and strength, but also to evangelize others. And that really struck me when I read it, because I realized I have no memory. I've not grown up in a culture where we were taught to memorize poetry or scripture or anything else, because I wasn't raised evangelical. That memorizing scripture was something that evangelicals did. We didn't do that sort of thing. So I was denied that opportunity. But I have to say, criticizing myself right now, I haven't availed myself of the opportunity as a 53-year-old man, because it's so easy, Hank, to go online and find what you want, or to go to my bookshelf and find what I want. But what do we do when the books are taken away from us? Or what do we do when, let's say, that all of our books become digitized? Because I have some books that are digital copies. They don't belong to us. They belong to Amazon. And Amazon can edit them as it sees fit, even though they're on our devices, and it can take them away. If corporations have that power, or the state should have that power, then no knowledge is stable if it's not committed to memory.
I have to also point to chapter 8 in your book, where you call religion the bedrock of resistance. And you and I are both Orthodox, and Orthodoxy is a belief system that really focuses on creeds and confessions. And creeds, as you point out, are a priceless possession, teaching us how to discern truth from lies.
That's right. Nothing is infallible. I mean, we have to remember that the Bolshevik Revolution happened in an Orthodox country. And people like Father Arseny, you probably read this book too. Father Arseny was this 20th century Russian Orthodox priest who became a legend in Russia for his writings from his time in the gulags. And Father Arseny tells a story about how when he was thrown into the gulag after the revolution, and a bunch of prisoners were standing around, all of them arguing about, you know, whose fault is it that this curse of Bolshevism came upon our country? And each one of them had somebody different to blame, but Father Arseny blamed himself. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, if we in the church had been more faithful to our calling, then this probably wouldn't have happened. Now, whether he's right historically or not is beside the point. His point is that the fact that Orthodoxy was the state religion and was the main religion in Russia didn't save Russia from the effects of the unfaithfulness of its clergy and of its Orthodox people. I'm careful saying that because, look, I went to a place in Russia, a field called Butovo Field, south of Moscow, which is the national memorial to all the victims of political violence. It was a field on which, in a 14-month period, sometime in the 30s, the KGB executed 21,000 people, including a number of priests and even bishops. There's a church there built to their martyrdom. So I'm not blaming the martyrs for what happened to them, but I'm simply saying that we all of us Christians, have a role to play in living out our baptism as faithfully as we possibly can. I'm grateful for the gift of Orthodoxy. I wasn't born Orthodox, but I'm grateful that God has given it to me because it does have this deep, deep well of creeds, of liturgies, of prayers that stand outside of time, and these testimonies of the saints going all the way from the early church all the way up to the martyrs and confessors of the 20th century yoke of Bolshevism to tell us in stories, not just in words or in written catechism, but in the testimony of their lives, what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ.
There's a couple more things and we have to wrap this up, but can't overlook chapter 10, one of the most important chapters in your book. Again, the book titled Live Not by Lies. It is available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy for your support on the web at equip.org. You talk about the gift of suffering. And you quote the haunting words of Solzhenitsyn, where he says, bless you, prison, for having been in my life.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? And why did he say, this man who wrote the Gulag Archipelago, this massive indictment of the Soviet prison camp system, won the Nobel Prize, why on earth would he praise prison and consider it a blessing? He did that because this is what woke him up. Truth what woke him up to what it meant to be human and what woke him up to the reality of God and Jesus Christ. You know, so he regarded this massive suffering as a gift to him. And this is how he got through it. This is the constant testimony of every one of these people I talk to and the people whose testimonies I've read doing research. I tell the story in this book, Hank, and this is probably the story that got to me the most and I think about the most. It's a story of a man named Alexander Ogorodnikov. He's still alive. He's 70 years old today, same age as you are.
Very, very young.
Yeah. Ogorodnikov came from a well-known communist family, and he himself was written up on the, he was on the front page as a teenager of the communist youth newspaper for being especially devout in his Bolshevism. But he lost his communist faith and accepted Christ when he was in his 20s and started a Christian movement in Moscow. Well, they eventually, in I think 1978, they put him in prison. And even though he didn't have a death sentence, they put him on death row because he came from a communist family. They wanted to make an example of him. So he goes on to tell a story about how he witnessed to people day in and day out, to some of the hardest men in all of Russia. He witnessed to them and led some of them to Christ. He goes on to talk about how they eventually put him in solitary confinement. He's treated horribly, beaten. His face to this day is still partially paralyzed from the beatings. And he told me that he got to a point where he was starting to doubt God, doubt God's presence, doubt God's purpose for him. Then one night as he lay sleeping, he was awakened by an angel and given a vision, a waking vision. This wasn't a dream, in which he saw a man with his hands cuffed behind him being led by two guards from the rear to his execution. And Ogorodnikov didn't really understand what was happening, but this vision, he kept getting the same vision night after night. It was a different man each time, but it had the same pattern. Eventually, he understood what was happening. The Lord was allowing him to see the men to whom he had witnessed being led to their execution, but it was actually a prelude to eternal glory, because even though the communists were about to kill these men were going to know eternity in heaven with God because Ogorodnikov had been present to bring them the gospel. And this changed everything for Ogorodnikov. He was able to understand his suffering in a new light, that in some mysterious way God had allowed it to happen to send his messenger, Alexander Ogorodnikov, into the bowels of hell in Russia to save, by presenting the gospel to them, to save these men for eternity. But the story gets even stranger. Ogorodnikov said he was later transferred to a little prison out in the country where he was the only inmate there, and his guard at night was a retired prison guard who just needed something to do. One night, the prison guard came to Ogorodnikov, started banging on the doors of his cell, saying, "You have to hear my confession. You have to hear my confession." And Ogorodnikov said, "Well, I'll hear you, but I'm not a priest. But what do you have to say to me?" The guard told him that earlier in his life and career, he, the guard, had been present when the KGB brought 50 Orthodox priests out to a clearing in the woods at night, lined them up one at a time, and went down the line saying to each one, "Do you believe in God?" If they would say yes, the KGB blew their brains out. And they lined the priest up in such a way that the shot into the forehead of the priest splattered the brains of that priest on the priest behind him. Every single one of those priests had his brains blown out in the defense of God. None of them denied Christ. They all went to their death. The old prison guard had seen this and been terrified by it all his life. He said to Ogorodnikov, "They come at night. They come at night," meaning the memories of the faces of those priests as they faced the gun in their face, asking them to deny Christ. Ogorodnikov started crying as he was telling me this story. We were in the Hotel Metropole in Moscow, and the luxury hotel, and this old man, Ogorodnikov, older man, sobbing, telling me this story. And he said, "I finally understood why the Lord did not let me see the faces of the men who were being led in my vision to their execution, because if I'd seen the horror on their faces, it would have shattered me. So God, by not showing me their faces, showed me a mercy." Now, Hank, I'm sitting there, an American who's known nothing but comfort and peace and religious freedom in a luxury hotel in central Moscow talking to an older man who had lived through that. And I got to tell you, you're not the same anymore. You can't unhear that. You can't unsee that. I highlight that story in my book because it is something absolutely vital for Americans to know that this can happen here. Solzhenitsyn said in the preface to the 1983 edition of Gulag Archipelago, the worst mistake anybody can make is to read this book and think what happened in Russia couldn't happen in their country. In fact, says Solzhenitsyn, it could happen anywhere on Earth given the right conditions.
Not only can, but will and is. Yeah. In light of your book, what's our mission? I'm thinking about the quote, and I think it's included in your book, where C.S. Lewis says, enemy occupied territory, that's what this world is. And the story of Christianity is how the rightful ruler has landed in disguise and is calling all of us to a great campaign of sabotage.
Yeah, you know, I think that so many of us Americans, maybe it's just the way they've been acculturated, but we think of, as Christians, that idea of sabotage requires taking the enemy head on. And often we confuse political action with furthering the kingdom of God. I think politics are important, but I think it's way, way too easy for us Christians to, whether we're on the left or the right, to substitute politics for doing the work to advance the kingdom. I think about the example that these brave men and women in the Soviet bloc set. Not a single one of them believed that they would ever live to see the end of communism. They did what they did. They suffered what they suffered because it was the right thing to do. And, you know, I can remember sitting in Moscow talking to this man, Viktor Popkov. He himself had gone to prison. He was part of Ogorodnikov's circle of young Christians in Moscow in the 70s. He had been put in prison, but he said he had been raised an atheist, and by the time he got to his early 20s, he was completely disillusioned with communism. There was no meaning to life anymore, and he was searching for something to make life worth living. He saw in the lives of these young Christians who were losing everything, but to be a Christian in Russian society and Soviet society meant you lost everything. You were the wretched of the earth. But he saw in their faces and in the way they lived a reason to hope. And he told me that when he joined the circle of young Christians there, that he said when we would get together and pray together and sing hymns together, even though we knew the KGB was outside watching us and that this was not going to end well for us eventually, he said it was the time we felt most alive and most free. And so I think about that, Hank, and about how the witness that Ogorodnikov and later Viktor Popkov and their circle gave to the people in that exhausted, cynical, beaten-down Soviet society of a different way to live. They could not take on the Soviet government directly. They would have been crushed. But they showed by the way they lived, they were a light shining in the darkness. And that is something I think that we cannot underestimate. Here we have in our little Orthodox church here in Baton Rouge, even in the time of COVID, we're still attracting more and more inquirers who want to know what it is about Orthodoxy. And the reason they're coming, or so they've told our pastor, is that they're coming from other churches that are more worldly and burnt out. And they know that the way of life that they've been shown in those churches, it's not going to be enough to get them through what's coming. And I find that just extraordinary. I think they're right, but it is incredible to me that they have managed to find our little church, even though to be Orthodox in the Deep South is an unusual thing, as you've learned. And, you know, we're not a fancy church. We're not a church that you're going to be introduced to elite social circles if you're part of. But there's something about the Orthodox Christian way of life that's drawing them in. And, you know, I'm an advocate for Orthodoxy, but I can say, too, that any form of Christianity in which people live it out in a confident way, in a disciplined way, and in a way where they allow themselves to die to themselves and so Christ can shine through them, that's the sort of thing that is going to not only draw new people to the faith, but keep the faith alive through some very dark times ahead.
You talk about the difference between church and church life. Rod, you are truly a treasure to the body of Christ, as is your book, Live Not by Lies. And I do want to say that the book, once again, is available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy for your support on the web at equip.org. We deeply appreciate every moment of your time, Rod, and may you be used by our great and glorious Heavenly Father to make a difference while there is yet time. I know few people that are making the kind of difference that you are.
Oh, you're very kind to say that. All the glory goes to God because, you know, He has shown me by His mercy to me, shown directly and also through the care and guidance of other people, how real He is and how He is the only reason to carry on. And if I could end with a couple of things real quick, Hank. My book is a book about hope. It's not a book about optimism. I don't think that we have reason to be optimistic in the sense of expecting that the best will inevitably happen. But I know we have every reason to be hopeful. For Christians, hope means not that the best inevitably will happen. Things might get very bad indeed. But as long as we hold on to Christ and offer all our suffering to Christ and do our very best to share in His suffering and proclaim His love and His lordship, no matter what they throw at us, then we have reason to hope because we know that God will ultimately use it for the good, as He used Alexander Ogorodnikov's willingness to suffer faithfully and bear witness, even in the bowels of the Soviet hell. And I would also say, too, my friend, that one thing I learned from talking to all these people, again, Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox, is that behind prison walls, the walls between the denominations fell because all those people realized that they weren't put in prison because they were Orthodox, because they were Catholic, because they were evangelical. They were put there because they confessed Jesus Christ. And they realized the deeper brotherhood that they were called to have under persecution. That's the kind of thing I want to see, or I hope to see, to live to see, and to help make happen in our country, this kind of ecumenism of the trenches. I don't want people to abandon their denominational distinctives. I'm going to stay Orthodox no matter what, but I'm absolutely going to stand there when my Protestant and my Catholic brothers and sisters are persecuted by big business, by the government, or anybody else, because if they come for any Christian, it could come for all Christians.
Yeah, beautifully said. Rod Dreher, the book, Live Not by Lies. Again, check it out on the web at equip.org. And remember to rate and review the podcast. Rod, thank you again. Your time is valuable, and your contribution today has been immense.
Thank you, Hank. May God bless your work here.
And yours. Out of time for this edition of Hank Unplugged, but we've got more podcasts coming down the line, so stay tuned for that. So long for now.